don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
We have had some very special moments on this show over the years, but this one tops the lot, surely. After almost a decade of second captains on RTE, Murph and I are walking up to the front door of Oros and Nuclearon, about to go in and meet President Michael D. Higgins. Murph, this is surreal, I gotta say.
Yeah, pretty much, Owen. But again, you know, you gotta think about this one. It's the power of the non-sportsperson crown. It's a title that even our president of 14 years desires, Owen. Just because he's the president, though. You know, it doesn't mean I'm just going to hand it over to him.
You are going to hand it over to him, Murph. You're going to crumble when the time comes to rank his sporting life.
Like a deck chair, Owen. I'm sure confidently predict.
I'm not the only one who's stood out there in the Phoenix Park a million times looking in at the aura. So to be on the other side for the very first time, it's quite a thrill. And we're getting to meet President Higgins just before he says goodbye to the place. After 14 years, over two terms, he will pass the keys on to his successor in just a couple of months, whoever that successor might be. The current president has been very visible in the role. He's been outspoken at times, possibly more outspoken than any of his predecessors. That's one of the things we'd hope to get a sense of when we chat to him inside. He's born in 1941, Murph. His father was born in the 1800s. I think the fact that Michael D. Higgins has ended up here as President of Ireland, it's even more extraordinary when you hear his dad's story.
Yeah, his dad, John, and his uncle and aunts were active in the IRA during the War of Independence, during the Civil War. His dad was on the anti-treaty side. He spent most of 1923 in the Curragh as an IRA internee. His uncle Peter, the uncle who later reared him, was on the pro-treaty side. So that choice of the president's father to fight for the anti-treaty side would kind of mar the rest of his life, really, in different ways. After he was released from the Curragh, he was told his old job wasn't there for him anymore, nor were there other jobs freely available for internees leaving the Curragh. They just weren't wanted anywhere. He struggled with ill health and a chronic chest condition as a result of having been on the run and sleeping out for long stretches. In the end, the president and his brother were sent to live with his uncle Peter in Clare, and that's where he grew up for the most part. And another angle to this as well is his father was forced again and again to apply for a state pension for his role in the War of Independence, which, as you can imagine, is kind of a great indignity. He eventually got his pension before the end of his life. But to think that that man's son lives here, that he got all the way to the Oros, it's quite astounding.
It is, yeah, it's incredible. We're here on a mission, of course, a mission to see if the president of our country can become the second captain's greatest non-sportsperson for 2025. His decades-long commitment to Galway United, that's going to help, as will the manner in which he carried out his presidential duties on big match days at Croke Park, the Aviva Stadium and further afield over the last 14 years, and the iconic celebration for Robbie Brady's goal against Italy. Come on! All of which is going to put him with a chance of claiming top spot. Murph, a reminder, please, of the mark he's chasing today.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
We have reached the halfway stage of this year's Greatest Non-Sportsperson Sportsperson Award, and Brian F. O'Byrne holds a slender lead at the top of our leaderboard on 83 points. So that is what Uachtaráin na hÉireann Micheál D. O'Higgins will be aiming to meet and beat today. But politicians are often concerned with posterity, Owen. What will their legacy be? Fellow Line of the Left union leader Mick Lynch got 77 points for a more than passable Socrates impression. Socrates is a Brazilian midfielder now, the Greek lad. Anti-apartheid campaigner Lord Peter Hain was our overall champ in 2019, and he only barely scraped past the Doughty challenge that summer of point guard par excellence Senator George Mitchell, who was as nimble on the hard courts of American college basketball as he was at the negotiating table. What will the sporting legacy of our president be? We're about to find out.
You can get in touch, as always, through Instagram at Second Captains or by emailing editor@secondcaptains.com. Okay, we're here. You ready, Murph?
I'm ready, Owen.
How do I look? Okay, presentable?
About as good as we could do with the materials provided, I would say.
Let's go in and meet the president.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. And you're ready to shout offside at over there. Not at all, no, please do. Oh, yeah, that'll do that.
President Michael D. Higgins, thank you so much for your warm welcome today.
You're very welcome, Fulshroof.
We are here in your study. Would you mind maybe describing the scene around us for our listeners?
Well, it's a scene that is currently undergoing some change. Normally, I would have nearly twice the number of books. They might have been in different places and piles and so on. But the great move is taking place, and my books are going to... there's going to be, a bigger library in the Ors when I leave. And as well as that, I'm donating some books to Galway University. And then some that I'm still working on, particularly in relation to hunger and Africa, that I'll be bringing to my house in Galway. I have a few obligations to do in writing. And then, because I believe that every book is printed and I made, as I like to say it, because there's other people's skills involved, is made to be read. So popular ones and ones that I think would be read most, I have been sending books to the public library for the last couple of years in different places.
So the great move is something that isn't done overnight when you're moving from somewhere like this. It takes a while.
The way it is that in this room is the room that I have spent probably most time in, and given interviews to all sorts of people sitting there, just look like yourselves. So it's a room that has meant a lot to me in a way. And I've written materials here in Redden. And I know that my desk went viral, and some people could be saying that it was a disgrace, that it was so disorganized, and other people enviously saying, I wish I could have something where I knew everything was, and I do know where all the stuff is.
It's a very specific system. Presidential eyes only can read that desk.
Yes, I do, of course, yes, and I look out at the Dublin Mountains, yes. Yeah.
One of the most visible parts of your presidency has been attending major sporting events in your role as president, and it's something, obviously you attended your final All-Ireland finals in that role this summer. I thought the reception you got from the crowd was particularly warm as you were leaving the field in those matches, almost like it was a sort of a farewell, a goodbye to you as president. Did you feel it that way?
I think what is there. I had a stroke on the 29th of February last year, and I spent 8 days in a hospital, and then I had very good treatment from the physios and from everyone. So I didn't cancel anything. So I can assure you I'm not flying up and down the steps to the same speed, but the point is I also used sticks, because what I need, the stroke was on my left side and it is mostly all back, but my balance is risky, so that's why I have to make sure. Mind you, if you were an egotist, falling over in front of such a wonderful crowd would have for sure created great compassion.
Were you still very much, and maybe the difficulty that you have physically in, for example, getting up and down those steps at Croke Park and the rest, were you still very much determined that that wasn't going to set you back, that you were still going to fulfil those roles and do those parts of the presidency that are very important to you?
If you think of, it's written by others as well, about my background in a way, is I didn't have barriers between me and anyone, and I don't internationally either. It's very interesting. I actually see my involvement in sport as going into the mix of people. It's one of the biggest reasons where I have never been involved in the officialdom of sports, really. Most of the time, what has interested me in it is of an instinct to belong. I actually, at the root of an awful lot of my writing in other areas, I see this business of wanting to belong and of wanting to get into it. And it's a child's thing too.
Well, maybe you could talk to us a little more about the role sport has played throughout your life,
yes,
how significant that role is and was when you were a child.
Oh, yeah. Well, this was the thing. And it's something I often thought about. If you, I was taught in a one-room school with Mr. Clune teaching the upper end of the class and Miss Hastings teaching the lower. But the yard itself was a hard, mud yard. And I remember people playing, for example, their own form of touch. We wouldn't have called it anything as sophisticated as touch rugby or anything like that, but mauling away on the ground. And then the reason is interesting. I was born in Limerick, but I went to live. My uncle and aunt took care of me from the age of five on, and they had a farm, and there was a great code called Junior B, which was multicolour insofar as that some people had the top half of the kit and the other people had the breast of it. But it had a bad reputation. And there was a team called Mahon Junior B, briefly in existence, and they practised in my uncle's field, down was the flattest of the fields, near the Ballycar railway station. So, but what the involvement I had then, at that time, I was a boarder in St. Flannan's College for 2 years. There was a compulsory hurling, because there was a man called Chalou who used to jump vertically within the sidelines as he was coaching his team. And the Harty Cup was the big deal, because winning the Harty Cup and the gold medal in Greek were the two great aspirations, apart from entering to the priesthood, of course. But in the case of hurling, I was a very bad hurler. My brother John had a trial for the Clare Minor team, I remember. So I ended up in the usual place you put people of dubious quality, which was a kind of cornerback or centre back and things like that. So, but the other side about St. Flannan's was it had four old core, the old handball alleys, as we would call them like that. And before going home, I was 8.5 miles from my home, you see. So you would 7 miles down to Newmarket Fergus, and we were another mile and a half on. And my brother and myself would cycle in and out. But before going home, I would always have a session. And the alley might have a kind of, as I said, it had no backboard, needless to say. And it had some touch. So we played both the softball and the hardball.
Yeah, well, we're going to come back to your handball prowess a little later in the show, President Higgins. But even though it seems you didn't exactly excel on the hurling pitch in school.
All right, on, easy up.
It's fair to say. Thankfully, you fared a lot better academically in St. Flannan's. Talk to us about your path when you left school and on into UCG. How did those years influence you and your worldview?
I had a distinguished living. That's what I'm saying, nothing about more. But the point about it is, after getting the leaving, you then got a booklet called in the Irish Independent, jobs and things, and you applied for the jobs in libraries and your jobs for DSB and CIA. And I was called to the ESB, and in a place, Newtown Smith. I didn't know what part of Galway it was in, or to speak about it. And I was a clerk in the ESB, grade 8. And then I was writing material. And I resigned my job to the horror of my mother, which I think it was just as well, because I won prizes like the Peel Prize for England, and Garrow the Tuhig and I went to college in the same day. That's why we're such close friends. And we would go, that time there were no open, there were no grants of any kind. So the two of us, either Garrow or myself, I'd finish first or second across a number of subjects in the university. So then we both went to England together on the ferry, on the boat, getting in to Holyhead and arriving in London and seeing all these people like ants appearing from the underground and with their hats and everything. This is just quite extraordinary. Garrow decided that he would stay in London and chance his luck there. I think he worked in a bar with people who had money to spare, maybe, but I must talk to McKenna about it. I went down to Sussex and I was doing a meaningless job as a filing clerk. And I said, this is not ridiculous. So I needed to go where the money is. So I became a barman, and then I trained then as a waiter. And with all its beautiful lies and hypocrisies that go with us. And we were living. I did that for, I was in the George Inn. Then I changed my mind. I was writing the, I wrote a piece for one of the Sunday papers about mods and rockers, because I was in Brighton for that time. Remember, I was born in 1941, so I'm 84, but the people who had been to England at that time was that, remember, a quarter of a million people went between 55 and 60. But at the dances or anything like that, women would talk, girls would talk about it, I'd say, he hasn't even been to England. Wow. Now, you can work it all out yourselves after that as to whether you were making a choice between someone. Is that not only the moves and the dance, but also all sorts of other experiences which were to be acquired in our neighbouring sinful island.
Indeed.
So that's how it all is there. And it is at that time I'm involved with a lot of left-wing groups. We would all unite, for example, to go to Stratford, to go out if Eleanor Cowell was speaking and things like that, and then we'd all disassemble and appear again and different things.
It seemed like when you started the presidency, you made a decision to continue to speak your mind where possible, I think it's fair to say. And one of the subjects you've spoken on very recently is Gaza. We were quite struck by video from you at the Fla Chéile when you were there. As you said at the time, you couldn't stand in a public venue, speak about Irish culture and language. It was obvious the pain in your face and your wife Sabina's as well. How much this is personally affecting you?
I find it tragic, this period. The interview I gave at the opening of the Fla was carried in Al Jazeera, and it has been on Iranian television, and it has been on Turkish television. And I got two letters yesterday from the Institute for Arab Studies in Paris saying that they're circulating. What I suggested in the letter, I'm a member of a group of non-executive presidents called Araiolos, and I sent a letter to them. This is not a time for silence and so forth. And among the people who replied to me was President Mattarella of Italy, and he said, would I have a go at drafting a statement, which all 16 of them would do. And I had a go at it. So I'm leaving it, and I'm waiting for the response to that. Where I am, which I think we must all be very, very careful of, we're at the realm of non-accountability. And we are in an extraordinary moment where you have three members of cabinet who are interested explicitly in illegality, but they're not worried about international law. And the other thing which is now proposed, which is a disaster, is in fact breaking the link between the West Bank and Gaza. The realm of unaccountability is the most dangerous threat to democracy. Can you imagine if we were discussing peace 30, 20, 30 years ago? You'd have discussions in Parliament, the appointment of negotiation teams. There'd be the discussion of text. And now you get two people meeting today, and you're not quite sure what either of them. How can that be seen in a way? And standing at the back of it is the unaccountable role of technology, the idea that you can shift it up to the arms race without taking into account the fundamental distinction with humanity itself. And I do think there's something that we need to be now, and that is, you can't use the genocide that is taking place as a distraction from the neglected political issues that you have been neglecting for so long. In relation to the Northern Ireland issue here and rest of it, there were times that people couldn't meet in the same room, but there was a permanent secretariat, and it produced text so that there was something to come back to. In the case of the Israeli-Palestine conflict, there was technically, remember, a group in place called the Quartet, which includes the United Nations, Russia, the United States, Israel, and so on. the quartet was hardly ever met. It'll give you an example of it. I think nearly the last person operating it was Tony Blair. And I got the impression that people hardly slowed their cars down near the hotel he was staying on the second floor. But the point is, it was neglected up to a particular point. And there are so many coming in, and they should carry the burden of having come into this issue so late. Now, the main thing is, I think, is for a global reassertion of the importance of the General Assembly. And I have been outlining recently how in the Charter there is a mechanism called Chapter 7, where if a certain proportion of the General Assembly support it, even if the Security Council uses the veto to block it, you can, in fact, the Secretary General can call for a force to be put together to guarantee humanitarian access with United Nations support. And that's what's in the letter that I have sent to my colleagues.
You've recently condemned the release of footage of Israeli hostages taken during the Hamas attacks of October 7th, 2023. But obviously our country has come in for criticism in Israel and in America, accused by one US senator of being on a hateful anti-Semitic path in relation to the Occupied Territories Bill.
Yes.
We know about the US congressmen and women who've claimed that if the bill passes, it'll have implications, significant implications for American companies here. How do you think Ireland can, as a country, can hold firm in the face of that kind of external pressure?
On the question of the business of trade, that's a fundamental moral basic. And you have to be part of the way that the collapse of the critique of capitalism came was it broke itself into sections so that you had people talking about trade autonomously, rights autonomously, justice autonomy, migration, so when they are all part of the same system. I think that I read that statement that young Palestinian journalist wrote anticipating his death. And I looked at the images of his partner and his two children and so forth. And when you get to the point of there is enough food for 3 months being blocked, and they said, President Robinson's interview was very valuable because she pointed out about the trucks being saying that they were too high and things like that. The other part which I remember, which Mary Robinson again mentioned and which I experienced when we were in Somalia, Mary Robinson was there and she went on to the United Nations, but that is in relation to the treatment of malnourishment of children. Some of the stuff, for example, being dropped from the sky isn't of much use at all, because basically there is a specialism in bringing back a child, particularly in relation to the effect on the brain. I must say, and all of us should say, I said about species and humanity, those brave people who are in the front line, those doctors, medical staff and others, and the people who have stayed. And I've spoken to surgeons who have carried out operations in just impossible conditions, and places with shortage even of oxygen, you know. So what one of the things that I have to live with, in a way, is that I have sat with people in tents in Gaza and the West Bank and elsewhere. In one of my last visits, the thing that moved me, one of the things that moved me most, was reading a medical report that showed that Palestinian children are more traumatized by the humiliation of their parents than by the death of either. And I wrote
from what they see on a daily basis, yes, what their parents go
through.
Yes,
but your point is in about this notion of the Occupied Territories Bill and the rest of it. Now, I don't want to be dragging out the thing very much, to simply say we are at actually a moral choice.
In December 2011, speaking in Galway, you were talking about how difficult you were finding it having left Galway, and there were reports that you were feeling somewhat homesick being here at that time in the early stages of your presidency. How do you think you'll feel as you finish the great move, as you called it earlier on? How do you think you're going to feel when you walk out the door for the final time here?
Well, all I know, I'm hearing talks about boxes and skips and books and everything. I'm very much looking forward. I'm going to be living in Rahun. And the disappointment for me, I suppose, was my little episode of last year. Beyond that, there are projects I'm continuing abroad as well as at home. And I do think I will run a few significant things that I haven't really got to deal with, that I want to put more on, and that is in relation to the elimination of violence against women. I also wanted to do a few more things because all my life I have been meeting the travellers and so forth, and I will probably do something. So there are a number of pieces that I have to finish before we go for the inauguration of my successor.
What would you like to see in Ireland's next president? What would you like their priorities to be?
Well, I can't possibly talk about the forthcoming events. All I know is that I do my best to have the place looking all right.
Well, if people are just tuning in today, you will have noticed this is a slightly different episode of Second Captain Saturday. We are here in the study in Áras an Uachtaráin, meeting President Higgins. More on the President's sporting prowess coming up next.
So an Uachtaráin, Micheál Dio, I gain and show on you, August Trishay and Ovlish, and the Himrori, August Nahibigi, Aaron Garpaid, Darragh, Ribbon.
Just give it to us straight up.
What a cheer for the president.
This is
massive.
That's unreal.
Houlihan. Inviting is there!
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
You're listening to a special episode of Second Captain Saturday. Owen and Murph here in Áras an Uachtaráin with renowned underage handball player President Michael D. Higgins. You've talked a bit about the sense of belonging that comes from sport and what it has meant to you. One of the big moments, one of the big sporting moments during your presidency was the Robbie Brady goal against Italy that got us through to the knockout
round. Well, first of all, there was this huge shock at protocol where I was semi-levitated in the stand. But afterwards, when meeting the team, it was in fact when everyone's congratulating everyone, and the kit man suddenly said, "There's the jersey." And that's that. And
sorry, you got Robbie Brady's jersey?
I'm not going to admit it.
But I've asked the question.
I'll say it was handed to me by the kit man. Okay, I'd have to find it. In fact, it is interesting because when I was in Argentina, I went and the president of Argentina then gave me a present of all the kit. And I looked and I said, "Would you haven't included Boca Junior?" And she grabbed the full day with this one. I think my son has that one.
What did that moment say to you about the idea of sport as a unifying force in the country? Robbie Brady's goal against Italy.
I do, but
also
you must have said before that we had the 90 team up here, and I was delighted that so many, including the 101-year-old kit man who came to see us that day.
Yeah, Charlie O'Leary, yes, we met him recently as well.
I think that one of the things about it is sense of belonging, celebration, and the truth is, I've loved the collectivity of sport. What I tend to remember the different people. It is that side of it I know, and on the times when I am doing in my position at the internationals and all of that, I think that there's a kind of a corporate gulf between between us, because maybe that's the problem is mine, because I was a board of directors of Galway United. I've been president of Galway United. I've done these kind of things.
So but Galway United had you as president before the country did.
Yes.
And you're a hardcore fan as well. You are a hardcore fan. I mean, you've been seen over the years at away ends at Talca and Daily Mount with 10 or 20 others, dyed in the wool supporters. How did you become a fan in the first place?
I'm exactly in the middle of St. Pat's and Bo's, and but I go up to rest. But first of all, I'm a person who is committed to the league for the simple reason, as much as anything, is that I know the families that are involved. I know the families, for, you know, in different places. I mean, sometimes now people come up and say, my grandfather said to say hello, you know, that kind of thing. But you go up, I went up and to the showgrounds in Sligo, the Bit of Red. And there you, at the half time when you went in and you saw all the confections. You couldn't believe all these cakes and sandwiches and all sorts of things arriving, until I realised that they had a very clever spread in their patrons. They had about 20 regulars. They had bakers and butchers and pubs and so forth. And I think I liked about the showground was that this is something I've liked about Irish football very, very much, are the people who walked the game. I mean, not enough is made of that, I think, at all, when people talk internationally about the experience of football, is that people can walk to the venue and walk home from the venue. And this is, I know, that when Irish citizens had a great, Irish supporters have a great reputation internationally. You know. And Sabina went to me to one game, I remember, and she said to me, Sabina's an actor, so she said to me, do you hear what they're saying about each other? And I said, oh, well, I said, that's all part of it, you see.
Well, your love of football will definitely help you in the next part of the interview, President Higgins, because as you know, the point of our show is to find our greatest non-sports person, sports person. Now, to do that, we need to learn more about your sporting pedigree. We're hearing handball is where you excelled, and this could be where you can earn some decent points from Murphy.
Yeah, you were a better than decent handball player by all accounts.
No, I think that I'm not really. I had the most magnificently humiliating experience. I was drawn in the Gaelic competition, half an hour, as you know, and I was drawn against Pat Kirby. Now there's a moment's reflection after hearing the draw and all the rest of it. And it was to be played out in the alley in Newmarket and Fergus.
Okay, I think I need to give some background on Pat Kirby here. Like, we're dealing with an utter legend of Irish handball. He won 15 national titles, 8 world titles. Like, he's Duxie Walsh for a previous generation. This guy was something else.
But I think history suggests I broke his service once. And as he went on later to world fame, and really, and he was a very disciplined, compact player. He hit the ball, he made a great connection with the ball. And he had the same thing. I remember him taking 21s in for Aero Oak and Innes as well.
Well, I don't want you to be too modest about your handball abilities, because when you were awarded the Freedom of Clare, Freedom of Ennis in 2013, the only person other than Muhammad Ali to get
it's
that honour.
To be on.
Classmates of yours at St. Fannin's described you as a feisty, combative sportsman whose technique in playing handball could be described as closed fist and overhand swipe. Does that sound?
Yes, it was closed. In fact, do you see, Pedro, we were pre-gloves.
Hmm.
And if you want to get to the competition, I have a bit of arthritis now. I think that I had fairly good eye to hand coordination. That part of it helped me.
So are we saying breaking the serve of a future world handball champion is your highlight?
It's got to be.
No, it's my most humiliating half an hour in memory. But he's lovely. He was a good person. No, there were two in competition, I think, for each other. I did mention, you know, winning the cup. Galway United winning the cup. And that Johnny Glynn knocking the ball down for Tommy Keane.
1991.
Thank you, yes, indeed. So we must not exclude that.
Well, maybe we can have joint highlights today, Murphy.
Yeah, I'll listen. That might be fair enough. Rules and protocols are out the window.
The time has come. And Ciarán Murphy, I'm very interested to hear how you're going to play this one, right? A reminder that Brian F. O'Byrne is our current season leader on 83 points. Murph, could you please do the honours and rank this sporting life of President Michael D. Higgins?
You don't understand. I could have had class.
We don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
What do you have, then?
People like me.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So this is a very special day for us all here, and we very much appreciate you opening your house to us. It's been a thrill. And as is customary when I'm being ushered out the door at parties, it's now time for me to stand up and rank my host out of 100 based on an extremely spurious set of arcane rules and ridiculous criteria. Yes, President Higgins, it's time for me to assess your sporting abilities, pick a sports person that I feel most closely resembles you in your sporting achievements, and then, having considered your all-time sporting highlight, give you points out of 100 to see if you'll be crowned our greatest non-sportsperson of 2025. Facing down the mighty Pat Kirby is a brush with Irish sporting immortality. Kirby was known as the Weekend Warrior for his outrageous run of success at weekend invitational events, and he is one of Ireland's true greats, as his list of national and world titles will attest. You were overmatched on that occasion, but sometimes the underdog succeeds. And so your rolling the dice on that occasion against the Weekend Warrior reminds me of what we've just mentioned. Galway United captain Johnny Glynn, not cowed by the odds, and instead scoring the winner against Cup specialist Shamrock Rovers in the 1991 FAI Cup Final. Your celebration of the Robbie Brady goal against Italy gave us one of the most iconic images in Irish sporting history. But more than that, your love of sport, which is obvious and effortless, and your simple belief that in sport we can see the very best of ourselves, gives purpose to all of us who love the simple idea of play and elevates the efforts of our national teams and greatest athletes. For that alone, it's my pleasure to award you a season-topping 90 points with every best wish from all of us here at Second Captains as you move on from the Oris. Uachtaráin na hÉireann, Mícheál D. O'Higgins, behin éad a hail sa sport. This has been your sporting life, Gura Míle Míle Máchas.
I'm sorry, well, that's not just a season.
Could I just say one thing? And that is, it's very important to remember that those we've been talking about sport, they're interested in all of the issues of the world and their fellow human beings.
President Michael D. Higgins is the first person ever to reach the 90-point mark. This is like Roger Bannister breaking the four-minute mile here. History has been achieved. Listen, before we say goodbye, I've got a couple of points I want to finish on. And thank you again for warm welcome today and for being so open with us. There's so much that is dark, and we've touched on some of it, in the world today. So as you get ready to leave your presidency, what are the positives you see? If we just take this country, what are the positives that we can cling to in Ireland at the end of your presidency, do you think?
Yes, I think that the positive is reflected, if you like, on the way that Irish people, probably Jews as well, in 1901, half the people born on the island of Ireland were living outside it. We are a people that have been spending migrants all over the world, but we've also had people running colonialism, but we had far, far more people teaching education. And that's why Ireland is welcome in places where other people are not. Now, what I think is very positive is when we send peacekeeping soldiers to the South Lebanon or whatever, and I've talked to them and I visited them there, they come back and they're the most informed people about the issue in the East, because they talk about it at home, it's carried into the schools and all of the rest of it. And the other thing, I visited Camp Shamrock when better times, and there are 14 communities, and the mayors of those 14 communities came to a reception in Camp Shamrock, because the way that the Irish interpret their mandate is by having good relations in this. Most of those 14 are now smashed rubble. But that, I think, in a way, on peacekeeping, I like to see it being expressed as it is the most important. We have a great reputation for it. I also think as well, the danger is in becoming a kind of the hind support of people who are not necessarily accountable. I think that the increasing militarization of Europe, we had all hoped for a Europe of peace. We'd all hoped for a Europe where children would go to each other's countries, where teachers would exchange, where we'd cooperate through horizon and science and so forth. And suddenly, we're having what are not the very accountable, continual pressures put on us that I think represent a real and significant danger. Sometimes you would have to ask yourself about the Commission, for example. Is it the Commission speaking or is it NATO? And it is a huge thing when you look at the geography of it all, and you must look at it in many, many cases. We are not setting out to be a military power. We are people who have sent millions to different parts of the world and who had our people received in communities. And these are complex things. But the most interesting thing, when I ran two big surveys in my first period in presidency, 800 young people, and I interviewed some people even in prison and whatever, and they never had equality outside of the top three. So that there is an ethical capacity still there in that. And the old days, remember, I'm from a time where if you had something to say, you stood in a wall. And they listened or they didn't, as they used to say in the old days. As soon as they said, Larkin, you used to get them to come, and Connolly, you used to get them to stay. But that discourse, you know, about it all, that my recent statement on the Indian community here was very much that, is that the poison that's getting at these young people. As a sociologist, you know, everyone is searching for some kind of significance or bonding and so on. But it's very, very important that we address that, about that poison. And the strange thing about it is this daft idea that a person who is in fact actually ultra poison doesn't accept democracy and so must be given equivalence with somebody. There must be the test of humanity in it all. But I'm remaining very, very. There is so much that can be done, and it is not just soft to say. It's a time for kindness and commitment and endurance and to continual reminder that nothing is inevitable and that all is possible.
And one final question. This is a quote from yourself a few years ago. As long as you're drawing breath, stay curious and keep going. Those are your words of advice. So what are you most curious about now heading into this next phase of your life?
Well, it is the thing. It is marvellous that Sabine and I have both been public figures all our life. I'm very much looking forward to spending some time with our two grandchildren. I have one grandchild, Finn is 2 years old and Fia is 4 years old. And I'm hoping to have more. I've done another thing as well. I've got all these books that I've got that I've just read one piece of and left aside to come back to. So I won't be stuck for something to do.
That's fair. That's a nice note to leave it on, I think. Listen, it's been absolutely incredible. A real honour as well. And well done on your score of 90 points in the greatest non-sportsperson competition. That is a high mark. A round of applause, please, for President Michael D. Higgins.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that's pretty much it for us from the Oars. Thanks to our series producer, Mark Horgan, and our producer, Killian Down. Thanks also to our second captain's producer, Kevin Brannigan, and to Johnny Lanigan in RTE. Thank you so much for listening. We're going to finish with the words of President Higgins. This is from his new spoken word album coming out early next month. It's called Against All Certainty, accompanied by music from Miles O'Reilly. This is the title track and poem, which is recorded right here in this very room. Enjoy, and we'll see you next week.
De
There is something so easy about certainty. In front of the shrine of St. Jude, the little white-haired lady looks anxious. In the main aisle, the middle-aged man in a grey suit and a beautiful, fresh, pink face looks certain. It is, I suppose, something like the difference between saving certificates and a lotto ticket. But I want her to win with St. Jude, at least share the jackpot, and I wouldn't collapse if he lost some of his certificates. Or is it I envy his certainty? Recalling times leaving the intimate smell of the confessional, I bent my head with that great relief that forgiveness was certain, and the sun shone with a blinding energy in my eyes when I came out, and the gravel sang to me outside the church under my foot, days of certainty. And if it was not for the fact that God did not call people like us, I might have loved to be imparting certainty in a sweaty box for life. The scruple is the maggot in the heart of certainty. It is it that breaks the core with its question. Are you sure you can be certain of anything for which you should be forgiven? A man came home from England and robbed on the boat between Holyhead and the city. He never knew his capital, felt he had been judged for only an occasional mass in England, punished to return with a dirty shirt and an empty pocket. All of us children heard him scream, or was it a cry? But only the banshee cried in our village, and he tore at the roots of the forest, saying he'd find the gold that all the old ones missed. And when they found him, his face was scraped as he rubbed his soil-filled nails around his wild eyes. He was never the same, we children were told, not to ask questions. And he never again was able to go home alone from games of 45. But passing up the hill where on the old road the bushes threatened to make a canopy, one's eyes could not avoid the shrine stone he chose, with its edge of moss upon which he knelt and prayed for forgiveness. Was it not a holy stone? And if the shift of guilty gravel was not in doubt, should one not kneel not only for him but for oneself? The soil under his nails and yours was poison. To clean one's nails in church was sacrilege that could never be told in a wooden box of sweat and a small curtain. There could never be certainty again. And if one looks and hopes the white-haired lady wins the jackpot with a little help from St. Jude, and if one gazes at the pink face of the man more certain, is it not a glance in a terrible mirror where those more certain can smile forever? And then if tears are not allowed, the grown person that was the child, is it not better to be uncertain, to have the scruple and throw away the apple that was certainty? For now you see them both, that cannot see each other, who kneel and the pain of the heart is real. And where there was gravel, there is the uncertainty of love that needs the polish of a restless wonder that gives those glimmers, even on occasions, that confirms we make our own uncertain magic.